This is the first part of a two-part series all about VBAC, or vaginal birth after cesarean. In this episode, I interview three different birth professionals about their experience and opinions about VBAC, as well as their top tips for any woman preparing for a VBAC in the future. I wanted to gather a variety of types of birth providers and supports for this episode, and I think it's applicable and helpful to more than just those people who are preparing for a VBAC. Anyone preparing for birth, this is for you. First, we have an OBGYN, then a home birth midwife, then a doula. My hope is that this episode leaves you feeling inspired about your future births and equipped with many practical tools and tips for processing past experiences, changing it up, finding proper support, and paving a new path for your future. Buckle up and let's go.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
And now for the interview with Dr. Nicholas Kapitanakis, DO and OBGYN. Okay, so today on the podcast, we have Dr. Kapitanakis, and I know you usually go by Dr. Kap, given that long, awesome Greek last name. So thank you for coming on to the podcast today to talk about VBAC.
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. I wanted to introduce you to the listeners so that they had a bit of an idea of who you are. And if any of you listening live in Southern California and are in any kind of a natural birth world or the birth space at all, I'm sure that you've heard of and probably met or worked with Dr. Kapitanakis in the past, and that's really cool. But I did, for anybody else who doesn't know, I wanted to read your bio. So it goes like this. Dr. Kapitanakis is a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist practicing in Encinitas and on staff at the Scripps Encinitas Memorial Hospital. As a doctor of osteopathic medicine, he takes a holistic approach in caring for his patients. He believes in order to successfully treat patients' complaints or the physical complaints, one must understand the entire system and recognize how each part of the body is interconnected to maximize one's healthcare needs. Woo woo! I totally agree with that. This philosophy is how he has come to specialize in unmedicated deliveries, VBAC births, minimally invasive surgery, and fertility treatments. So you're the perfect person to talk to today with that impressive track record. And, you know, you're one of the people that is the, like, what's the word? Like, you're the champion, I feel like, in that Southern California birth community of OBGYNs that are very supportive of the unmedicated birth and supportive of things that maybe people can't or aren't really going to get the support from other doctors, whether that is a VBAC or maybe breech, or, you know, you'll attempt twins vaginally or more than the average doctor, it seems. How did you kind of come to this confidence and working with women in this space and sphere? And why do you think there's not more people like you? If we could clone you, that would be awesome.
Yeah, that would be great. I could get some time off, maybe take a nap here or there, and, you know, get a little bit of time to hang out with the kiddos. You know, it's a great question. I know I've thought about it kind of long and hard and why the current medical system does training in residency the way it does. And I just came to realize very early on in my career that when women are supported and empowered, the outcomes are so much better. When we give them the tools, answer the questions, take away the fears, they're amazing. They're so powerful. I mean, we can talk for hours and hours and hours on this, but, you know, my wife and I, we had three unmedicated births. I delivered my son at home. And to see that power and confidence in women, it's always been there, but somewhere along the line, the medical system, you know, convinced women and took their power and said, "Hey, you need to be in a hospital. You need me to take care of you. You need me to be able to have a baby." But up until that point, the majority of babies were out of hospital, and at the home setting under the care of midwives. And that got moved into the hospital setting. And so women early on, you know, last century, you know, kind of lost that power. And I came to realize that if you support people and empower them, you can have amazing outcomes. And what the medical system doesn't get is that you have happier patients, you have healthier patients, And to be honest, I do less work. I mean, I tell my patients, if you see me too often in labor, that means that something's going on. Because if you take a hands-off approach and really let the body do what it's going to do, the outcomes are amazing. And you have happier patients and better outcomes. But why the system hasn't supported that, you know, I'm dumbfounded. I still don't know.
Yeah, I feel like anybody who's an advocate in this space is kind of looking at it from a 10,000 foot view, and it seems so obvious, right? Like, it's like, why can't like the majority of the system, you know, in quotes, whatever that means, come to understand this, right? Like, there's some sort of a blend of old thinking mixed with just the legalities of hospital policy and insurance. And I understand that that is a tricky aspect of it too. And then somehow maybe there's like a bit of a power dynamic here, and then there's 10% this, 10% that, and it's all these different things that have come to. And then, you know, culture and media and women from little girls growing up thinking like, this is going to be the most painful, awful day of your whole life.
Yeah.
And that doesn't help anything, you know? And sure. So part of my goal, part of your goal, and you know, the reason why we do the work we do is helping to change that story so that people can have different experiences and know really deeply in their soul how amazing and transformative coming into motherhood with an empowered birth story, however that might look, is. And so specifically with VBAC, you know, there's many different reasons why a woman may have had a cesarean birth at one point or another. So VBAC stands for vaginal birth after cesarean, or cesarean otherwise known as C-section. And so maybe they had to have an emergency C-section during their first birth, or some birth along the way. Maybe there was a breech baby. Maybe they had twins. Maybe they had something going on. I don't know. And now they're pregnant again. They're wanting to plan to have a vaginal birth. And, you know, many years ago, I don't exactly know the dates, but it was sort of this idea that once you're cut, you're always cut, or once a section, always a section.
Yeah.
And then that has changed now. So I want you to speak kind of about how we've come throughout history to think about VBAC, and in your opinion, what actually is safer? Is it a repeat cesarean? Is it to try for a vaginal birth? And what are the statistics of success in your practice in general, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, obviously super complicated question, because yeah. Depending on where you look, right, statistic-wise, you know, if you look at my practice, and we have a, you know, 15%, 12%, last month I didn't do any primary C-section. So our rates are, you know, extremely low when you're talking about, you know, a primary C-section, which is a first time, you know, mom essentially ending up with what I like to call a belly birth. You know, we've medicalized that also. So, you know, we obviously do a lot of trauma counseling when patients come to me for VBACs, because there's just so much that goes into it. And really, you know, sitting and talking with patients and trying to digest, you know, kind of what happened and where did things go in a different kind of way that you thought or anticipated. And then at the end of the day, saying, hey, what are you really looking for? Are you looking for, you know, the vaginal birth part? Are you looking for the skin to skin? Are you looking for the breastfeeding in the OR? Are you looking for a quicker recovery? And really kind of digesting it. So I don't know the exact date, to be honest with you, but probably 30 years ago, we were doing vaginal births after C-sections. A study came out that said there was a higher risk for uterine rupture, and then the pendulum swung. And that's kind of what happens in medicine. The pendulum swings from one way to the other. Then it was, let's not do any more VBACs, and they're dangerous. And then the data finally gets teased out, and the studies, you know, kind of get looked at a little bit more thoroughly. And they say, really, wait a minute, the risks aren't what we thought. And we should offer women with a prior C-section, you know, the opportunity for a vaginal birth. So the American College of OBGYNs, or ACOG, came out, you know, with a statement saying, you know, patients without any contraindications, and there's very few of those, you know, should be offered a vaginal birth after C-section. To answer the question about, you know, statistic wise, it depends on the provider. I mean, you have some providers that are VBAC tolerant, you know, which is not VBAC supportive. That's like telling you what you want to hear, patting you on the head, and then saying, you know, yeah, we'll do that. And in the back of my mind saying, oh, but if you don't have a baby by X amount, you should have a C-section. But it's really looking at the statistics and saying, you know, what really has been shown. VBACs do obviously carry some risk. They're, you know, if you look at it, maybe a 0.5%, so 0.5% chance of uterine rupture, which is kind of the big one that everybody talks about. And then you say, well, what are my risks if I had a repeat C-section? And probably most would say probably around, you know, 0.5. And that's for infection, that's for hemorrhage, that's for scar tissue, that's for long-term pain. So sometimes you're kind of trying to balance the risk and where do I want to mitigate that risk? And is it more, you know, on me surgically, or is it more, you know, potentially for this small concern for uterine rupture? And then deciding, you know, what is best for you. In our practice, I mean, we're very successful. We do a lot of VBACs, and, you know, we were pretty much the first at Encinitas who was doing a VBAC after two C-sections, and we've been successful with that. So a few years ago, American College of OBGYN came out and says, hey, we've looked at the data, you know, the risk after two C-sections for uterine rupture might be 1%. We should be offering it to those moms also. So, you know, those moms should be afforded that opportunity. The problem is you don't have providers who are willing to go to bat for patients and who are willing to, you know, kind of go the extra mile, spend the time with patients and really find out what they would like, and then how to empower them to have that. I mean, we've had a patient that had had two prior C-sections, came to me, said, I would like a VBAC. We talked about it. I said, okay, let's do it. And she had, you know, basically an unmedicated 9-pound baby. She moves away to Dubai, gets pregnant again, says, nobody's going to touch me except Dr. Kapp, flies back here on her own at 36 weeks and says, no way, they want to give me a repeat. And I pushed out a 9-pound baby and they won't let me, you know, have this vaginal birth. And she called my wife, Angie, who runs the office. And Angie's like, all right, we'll come out. And she's like, well, I live in Dubai. And Angie's like, okay, great. Come out at, you know, 35 weeks and stay here. And she came here without her kids and she rocked out another VBAC and then she went home. You know, sometimes you have to do a little bit of that legwork and find a provider who, you know, is willing to kind of go the extra mile for you.
So what is it that you think that, like, what is it that you in your office are doing to continue to support these VBACs? Why are they successful under your care versus somebody else? Is it because the other practitioners, like you were mentioning, you know, they don't really want to talk to the patient, dig in, talk about the trauma, talk about what their wishes and wants are, and then also maybe they're just not willing to spend the time? Or do you think that, like, there's something happening for providers where at the end, you know, a woman is 40 weeks, 41 weeks, and they just are getting to be like, is it that they're worried of the uterine rupture? Or why is it that they cannot just continue to be supportive of a vaginal birth, like as if it was their first vaginal birth or something?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not 100% sure why that is. You know, from what I hear when patients come to me before, you know, they're like, oh, the rate of uterine rupture increases the longer you wait, which I haven't seen that data. So I can't confirm that or say that it's true or not true. If you look at the data and you say, what's my success rate? And you really like look at statistics, which I'm not a huge fan of, to be honest with you, with statistics, because I've seen, you know, many different things. And you say, well, if I go past 41 weeks, is my chance for a successful VBAC go down compared to if I went into labor at 40 weeks. And so that might be part of it, is that, you know, maybe the success rate goes down, but I think that's up to the patient. And, you know, I haven't looked at the numbers. Again, I don't like to quote statistics. You know, I would tell patients, hey, you know, in general, we want your body to go into labor. We don't want to get involved. We don't want to break your water. We don't want to induce you. We really want to wait and see what happens and then give you the tools, the comfort measures to be able to, you know, labor as long as you can. If you don't want an epidural, great. Don't get an epidural. Really follow what your body is telling you. But when you have practitioners saying, hey, we should put something on the books. Hey, I think your belly is big. Hey, I think your baby is big. Hey, I think your pelvis is small. And you start putting those little seeds of doubt in women's mind. You know, they tend to, you know, kind of think about that. Oh, my practitioner said, you know, I have a big baby. Or my practitioner says, if I go past, you know, 40 weeks that this isn't going to happen. And then I have to schedule and, you know, all of that. And so I think it just puts too much pressure on the whole process. And, you know, it's, you know, women are mammals. If you think about a cat in the wild, if they get scared when they're in labor, they can shut down their labor, run, hide, go to the barn where it's nice and dark and quiet. And then mama feels, you know, safe, and then bring on that labor. I mean, women are no different. If they have that anxiety, if they have that fear, that trepidation, it could put a, you know, slowdown, or if not a stop, you know, on that vaginal birth attempt. So super important to trust the body and, you know, realize, yes, okay, things can happen. But that's more on the rare side, but having somebody, you know, a doula, and I know, you know, it's a part, you know, you're doing a 3-part series where you're going to talk to, you know, a doula who supports VBACs. I mean, those are all important things to build your birth team, so that you know who's going to support you and be there and give you the tools you need.
Yeah. And I think as somebody too, who I've been the doula figure for a couple of women who are using you as their OBGYN in San Diego over the last 8 years. And I think one thing that stood out to me that was different about working with your team of nurses and you versus maybe other experiences that I've had with hospital births would be that your nurses are, they're not an extension of you, but they are trained for the way that you approach things. And they were so incredibly supportive in this very like full way. There was no contradicting opinions happening. There was no, you know, if the woman didn't want to have the epidural, nobody was pushing it. Nobody was asking for it. They were really leaving her alone, like very minimal check-ins at all. And all of these different things that come to breed this sort of experience where, yes, it as part of the birth team, you know, there's all these other factors that come in. And my point in saying this is just that I think that because they are under you and they're working with you and you have this certain philosophy, that's very important. And sometimes, like you've said too, for a woman who's birthing in the hospital, sometimes you don't really see the doctor all that much. And there's these other people who are going to be part of this experience for you. And they also need to be on par with whatever your plan is and your goal. And so obviously it's helpful if they are in the same mindset and philosophy as the provider themselves, just in their, you know, attitudes or how often they're coming in or whatever it is, because being the poked and prodded and all the different things like we know about your cat example doesn't help. And it's really like, if we can just take a step back and monitor with a watchful eye, it's not like anybody's being irresponsible here. It's you're watching and, you know, are there signs of anything happening? Then we need to intervene. But otherwise, like, let's just let her do her thing. Let it kind of happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think that goes back to kind of residency training. I mean, I'm going to talk, I guess, two things, but, you know, residency training, you're checking every patient every 2 hours, and are they on the curve, you know, what was called the Friedman curve, and are they progressing? And if they're not progressing, then we have to break their water or do Pitocin or get involved. And, you know, that as a resident, you were like, oh, we cleared the board, we got everybody delivered. And you're like, well, did everybody have a good time? Did everybody get what they wanted? You know, I remember stories, patients would show up and in residency with a birth plan. And then people were like, oh, get the operating room ready. It was just this notion, this negative thing of, you know, patients want to empower themselves and, you know, learn and choose maybe to birth in a different scenario or in a different way. And the residency programs of today aren't really supporting that as much as they should be. Now, I've been at a residency for some time, so I don't know what they're doing now. But when I came to here to Scripps Encinitas, and I've been here 15 years, I mean, the nurses quickly learned that when a CAP patient comes in, it's going to be intermittent monitoring. It's going to be let them walk around. It's going to be don't ask pain scales. It's going to be don't offer them an epidural. They'll tell you what they want. It's going to be let them eat, let them drink, let them move. And when they start feeling pressure, then we'll, you know, do another cervical exam and see, hey, all right, you're ready. Let's start pushing. But, you know, we're not examining patients every 2 hours, and we're not putting that pressure that, you know, your cervix has to do something X, Y, Z in some time frame. Now, thankfully, that curve has been, you know, changed a little bit. And now American College of OBGYN says, hey, we need to give people more time. We need to really give people more time before we make decisions. But it's hard. It's hard to get rid of that training to say, hey, let's go 4 or 5 hours without a cervical check. I mean, what's going to happen? You know, we're either going to make progress or we're not. The baby is fine. So I kind of learned really early on that the best role that I could do was to sit on my hands and not get involved and train and teach my nurses like, hey, when we don't, good things happen. Now, do other things happen? Sure. And we're ready for that. You're in the hospital. You have 24-hour anesthesia. You have an OBGYN there. You have a team there. You have amazing nurses. You have an OR. And so if something was to happen, really their job is safety. You know, make sure baby and mom do okay. Other than that, I you know, the whole process of, you know, pain scales and this and that, we don't need it. We don't need it. Patients will tell you what they want. You know, I'm on a lot of different committees down here, through the hospital, about, you know, reducing our C-section rates and empowering patients. And how do we do that? And education, is definitely my number one. And then, you know, getting a doula, definitely number two. And then being in a hospital that's going to support what you want. And you're right. You've seen births at you know, Encinitas, and you've seen just how the nurses are. And the nurses are amazing. I think I couldn't do what I do without them, you know, by far, because they have kind of been able to see that we can do things better and not be so always nervous about everything. And so that, you know, allows that empowerment to be kind of transferred to the patient. And I'm just, again, here for safety, and whatever is going to happen is going to happen. I always kind of joke, I don't like breaking water. I don't like doing a lot of Pitocin. I don't like doing any of that stuff, because the next thing something happens and I'm like, wow, did I cause that? Should I have not done that? And I learned that early on in residency training, you know, especially breaking water early on in labor. I mean, really leave the process alone. And if the baby comes out in the bag, it's a pretty cool delivery. You know, there's no rush to do that. And yeah, it's just a different train of thought.
Yeah. And this is, you know, the mindset shift that you're describing too is, I think, what a lot of people associate with like the midwifery model of care, which is that birth is physiologically normal and we need to allow it to happen. And then if there is a problem, like you said, then that's when you do things. But it seems like probably because you've done this for so long, you've done it this particular way for a very long period of time too. And then now your nurses are kind of feeding off your very calm, confident energy about it. And same thing with your patients. It's like in parenting, you know, you have 3 kids, I have 4. It's like, if you come off with an air of confidence when you're trying to allow your child to do something, or you're trying to teach them something or whatever, and you know, they're trying to learn a concept and it's hard, or they're working through something. And if you're very like anxious and worked up, they're feeding off of your nervous system on that, and it's not going to go very well. But if you can just be really rooted in, I know you can do this, I've got it, I'm watching you, you know, that I think can speak volumes. And the provider idea of like the VBAC tolerant, as you were mentioning in the beginning, versus VBAC supportive is so huge. That is so huge. And yeah, so I think along with what you were saying of getting a doula and being and doing a good probably birth education course and then finding a good provider, like these things, your good provider really, really needs to be somebody who's truly, truly believing in women and has that kind of a perspective that this is a physiological normal process. Yes, there are some risks involved with every single kind of birth, of course. This is a very large event, and that's what makes birth amazing too, is it is like the biggest deal. But the vast majority of the time it's going to go well. And it goes even better when we don't poke and prod and get muddled in it and pull the woman out of her, you know, primal space and ask about the pain scale and, you know, be talking to her between, you know, during a contraction or doing whatever it is and pulling her out and pressuring her, and you're not dilating. And if, you know, I'm going to call section if you're not ready in a couple hours or whatever.
Yeah, you're like, in trouble.
Yeah. It's like that, you know, the pressure to perform, the pressure of being watched and, or watched like a watched pot rather, especially with a first birth that may be very long, and that's normal, you know? And once that really strong active labor pattern can kick off and it's kind of that runaway train that's not going to stop. Right. But like, until that happens, I think there's so much that can meddle with this. And it seems like the lesson here is really doing less is the most beneficial. Watching from afar with a watchful eye. And it's not like you're being negligent. It's like you're watching and you're being very careful. And you know that the outcome is going to be better the less that you do. I think I can understand too why certain providers would be the way that they're trained, like you said, and it kind of feels like, well, this is your job. It's like, this is what you do. You do something, like you are a part of the process. And really, I think it all needs to unravel to say, no, your part of the process is to like stand on the outside and just let her do her thing. Right. And that can be kind of wild. And I get that it doesn't really fit with schedules very well. And it doesn't fit with the way that we like to, you know, put things as human. We like to put things in a box and have predictability, and birth is not predictable. And that can really screw with people's mindsets. And I get that. And it's like, well, then maybe that's not the right position for certain people to take. If they want to do surgery, but they want it to be more predictable, then it's maybe, you know, like some other kind of a specialty. But birth is this very, it's almost like you're an architect in a way. My dad is an architect, and he's always described it to me as being a very unique job his whole life, because he's an artist and he's an engineer. And so it's like right and left brain. I feel like OBGYNs, in the case, you know, of the type of OBGYN that you are, it's like you do have this like extreme skill set with surgery and being able to take care of these very, you know, emergent, high stake problems. And you have to be able to hold this well, but if I don't do anything, like this really should go well just on its own. So you're sort of like in between worlds, right and left brain at all times.
Yeah. I always like to say I'm kind of a more of a birth Sherpa, you know, I kind of like show you some routes. So I kind of carry your stuff, but I'm more in the background and you're the one doing the work. Like, yeah, I'm going to go with you. I'm going to be there. But I always tell patients, I'm not the important one. I mean, you know, 90% of birth is mental to me. It's not the physical part. It's the mental part. I mean, I just delivered a patient this weekend, unmedicated. She wasn't a VBAC, but she did amazing. And she pushed out a 10-pound baby with a tiny little tear. And afterwards, unmedicated. And she goes, hey, did you know this was a good sized baby? I go, yeah. I mean, I had a feeling, but what does that do for you? If I tell you, hey, I think you have a 9-10 pound baby, I mean, your head is going to start to think and you're going to be, oh my gosh, can I do it? Is this going to fit? Am I going to end up with a C-section? And out came a 10-pound baby. Fine, happy, mom's ecstatic, baby's doing great. She gets up, she showers. And really that it's very basic. It's basic skill sets of, you know, what would you do in the playground? And you were gonna empower your friends and you're gonna be nice. And yeah, you know, you're right. I do have a different skill set, but the vast majority of the time I want to use the other skill set. You know, I want patients to leave happier than when they came in. And I tell that to patients all the time. I say, hey, listen, you should leave every appointment more empowered, more comfortable, more comforted, you know, than you came in. You know, you should get all your questions answered. You need, you know, you have to have as much time as you need to answer those questions. You can't feel rushed. Every patient I come in, I sit in the chair. Hey, what's going on? I don't ask medical questions. I go, hey, how's it going? What's new? You know, that's kind of how I start. And, you know, sometimes it's blah, blah, blah. Oh my gosh, car accidents or this or family stuff. It has nothing to do with medicine. It's just about connecting with people, getting trust established. And then, yes, okay, make sure everything else is fine. But for the majority of the time, it's really about supporting that and that level of trust, which is extremely important in any kind of birth.
I love that. That's amazing. And that's definitely not the norm, and I wish it was, right? Like we need to continue to kind of spread this, and you know, you serving as a mentor for new grads that are coming out and showing them the way that this is how it can be and that this is how you can have these really important, impactful relationships with your patients. And I'm sure it's much more fulfilling for you to have it go that way than for maybe the way that it's going for others that, you know, unhappy patients or really no connection or relationship with them at all. And it's just kind of like this spinning wheel of in, out, in, out, in, out. And it's like, well, we are humans. We are drawn and, you know, made for connection. That's kind of what makes us unique in that way. And it should always be the center of it when it can be. Obviously, again, I just want to keep saying it. I know that everybody knows, but we're not like trying to say that there's nothing that can happen poorly in a birth setting because it can, but we also have to remember that that's not the norm. That is not the majority of instances. That is thankfully on the more rare side. And so as women who are listening to this and preparing, know that, you know, your body is made for this. This is like going to most likely go very well. You want to pick your people who are going to support you. You want to feel like you really understand what's going on, and that doing, you know, do whatever it needs to be done so that you can just sit in this space of feeling like everybody's got me, I'm good. And you can go in, you can go into your inward labor land and chug out a 10 pound baby unmedicated. Like, that's amazing. And not be worried about it and not be fear mongered.
Yeah. One thing though, you know, for me is I think there's so much external forces that go into things to decide what I want to do. And what, again, I mentioned it earlier, when I see patients early on, you know, for that first visit and we talk about your previous births, it's really trying to dissect that out and seeing what did you miss? Was it, you know, you felt like your power was taken, you felt like you didn't have a choice, you know, all the other things, again, skin to skin and, you know, breastfeeding in the OR, and I was separated from my baby and I don't remember anything and all of that stuff. I also want to say that, you know, it's important if a woman after that long discussion decides, hey, I just want to have a nice, gentle, quiet, calm belly birth. And yeah. I don't want to say that everybody should have a VBAC attempt, but everybody should be offered it, right? And everybody should be encouraged. Hey, if that's what you want to do, I'm here for you and I'm going to support you. And I tell patients that all the time. I said, my job is not to you know, steer you in a direction that I think you should go. My job is to be here, talk about all the different situations, and then decide, you know, between you and your partner, what you think is best for you guys. And then let's make it the most amazing delivery, whatever that situation is. And we can talk another podcast about, you know, what is a gentle, you know, cesarean or gentle belly birth and how does that look and how's that different, you know, so all of that is important. But it's just important to again, support women and support their choices and be 100% invested in what they choose to do, and support them through that and keep again, her and baby safe.
I'm really glad you said that, because I do know multiple women that come to mind immediately who, for whatever reason, different situations, you know, something traumatic happened and they didn't want to risk it again, or they wanted to have that just predictable and calm. And yeah, the maternal assisted or the gentle cesarean or belly birth experience. And for them, that was like so healing. And mm-hmm. came full circle, redemptive. It was like a beautiful birth. And that is the reality as well for certain situations. And so I'm glad you said that, because we're definitely not trying to say that everybody needs to have a VBAC. It's more just the idea that if you have had a cesarean, you are not doomed to always have cesareans. If that's not what you want to do, you can have VBACs. And now the research is definitely more supportive of this as, you know, it's not like this insane risky thing I think that we used to think of yesteryear. It is, the risks are about the same. And so it should be something that's offered, and then we can, you know, make pivots along the plan as it needs to happen. So thank you so much, Dr. Kapp, for your time coming on today. And I definitely will be rescheduling an episode with you about what does a gentle mother-centered belly birth look like, because if that might be a new concept to people they've never heard. And so I want to get that information out there, that that's something that people can plan for. And I really appreciate your time and expertise. So thank you for everything you're doing.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. Keep empowering people and keep supporting them, and good things will come.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. Did you know that 97% of women in the US take a prenatal supplement, yet 95% plus are still deficient in key nutrients? My favorite prenatal is from a company called Needed, because they dose nutrients at levels to not just meet the bare minimum as most prenatals do. They actually use form of nutrients and dosages that allow mama and baby to thrive. Needed actually approached me years ago and asked me if I could help them design the perfect prenatal, because they knew that the current prenatals available were not actually helping women. We spent over 3 years diving into the research and understanding what practitioners are seeing and what women actually need at this important season before we formulated this amazingly supportive option. It's no wonder over 4,000 practitioners now recommend Needed, something I am very proud of. If you have followed me for a while, you know that prenatals and optimizing nutrients starts long before pregnancy, so no matter where you are along your fertility or motherhood journey, Needed is the brand I recommend. Head to thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% on your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%. Okay, back to the show.
And now for the interview with Julianne Robinson, certified professional midwife and licensed midwife. Okay, welcome to the podcast, Julianne. So I'm super happy that you're here with us. This is part of the big podcast episode on VBAC from the practitioner's side of things, the OB, the midwife, and then the doula. You are the midwife, the home birth midwife here that we're going to talk. But first, I want to introduce the listeners to you so that they know who you are, what you're about, and then we're just going to have a nice little conversation about VBACs. So Julianne, or Jewel, you go by, is passionate about... Yeah, that one, you liked Jewel. Okay, I can go by Jewel. You know how it is like when you first meet somebody, whatever it is the name that they give you when you first meet them, forever
they're that name. It totally is. Yeah. Either one is fine. I respond to either one, so.
Okay, good. That's good. Okay, maybe I'll just stick with Julianne then. Yeah. Because Jewel is like, I get major, I don't know if Jewel, the musician, is from Boise, but
she's
has a song.
She has
a song called, I think it's Jewel, that's called There's No Z in Boise.
Oh my gosh, she does?
Yeah, or there's something, or she sang it, or I don't know. Maybe this is all hearsay. I'm having a memory though of childhood and being like, gosh, yeah, because everyone, I'm from here, so like everyone would say Boise oh, this,
totally.
Boise
State. It's and Boise, like, yeah.
Yes, it's Boise, yeah. So anyways, yeah. Okay. Back to your bio so people know who you are.
Okay.
Julianne is passionate about empowering and educating expectant mothers by utilizing a holistic approach to midwifery. Since 2020, Julianne has worked in two clinical home birth practices and numerous community birth centers, with numerous community birth midwives in the Treasure Valley. She has strong relationships with other birth workers and allopathic practitioners in the community, and these clinical experiences showed her how impactful midwifery can be. In addition to midwifery services, Julianne offers a specialized online home birth education course, Hello Home Birth, for expectant families to prepare themselves for the duration of their pregnancy and postpartum months, as well as education and counseling on the importance of environmental toxins, nutrition, and holistic health. I will put, by the way, just so everybody knows listening to this, I will put that link in the show notes in case you want to check that out. Julianne lives in Boise with her two sons, fiance, and three German Shorthair pointers. She's passionate about herbal medicine and often in the kitchen crafting up herbal goodness. And Julianne is the owner and creator of Descended Traditions, an Ayurvedic postpartum meal service that serves nourishing and ancestral-centered meals to new families that are in and around the Treasure Valley, which, by the way, I just have to say, if you live in the Treasure Valley and you are planning on becoming postpartum anytime soon, you need to get in on this because your food is some of the most amazing and just like highly sought after too. I don't even know how you have time to do it because I know that you need to have like, you need to clone yourself so that you can make more of this amazing food. It's so good. Okay. And then you attended the Midwives College of Utah where you're currently also an instructor. You graduated summa cum laude, with a bachelor's degree in midwifery and you're a licensed midwife in the state of Idaho. So you are just a baller and you have done so much for the kind of birth culture and postpartum culture, really. I know that a lot of your passion is around that postpartum time in the Treasure Valley. So I just really want to thank you for everything that you do. And thank you for being here with us today as well. And so let's talk about VBAC from a home birth midwifery perspective. For you, just in general, kind of what do you think about it? Do you feel like VBAC at home is a good option for most people? What's the difference? Is there a difference? What's this whole thing about VBAC? Why are people not supportive? Like whatever it is that you want to say about it, I just want people to get
that's
that.
That's a lot of questions, Morgan.
Yeah. Sorry. I know. I'm giving you ideas. Like, I'm brainstorming you. You can just pop off and talk about any one of these.
Let's start. Yeah. Okay. So I think that, first of all, VBAC, HVAC, you know, VBAC and HVAC are terms given to people who have already had a successful VBAC or an HVAC. And HVAC is home birth after cesarean. So we like to talk about people like when they haven't had, so they've already had a C-section or they've had one or two prior C-sections, they don't want to have another C-section. They go into what's like a trial of labor, right? A TOLAC. And who is the best candidate for something like that is essentially what you would be asking me, right? I honestly think anybody who has had a previous C-section would be an awesome candidate for something like this, whether it be in the hospital or at home. And obviously, I'm going to advocate for anybody like doing this in the home setting, because based on evidence and based on research, having a provider who is not afraid of a VBAC or the trial to get to a VBAC or an HVAC is going to give you the most success in actually having one. So really, you just need to find a provider who's going to support that, who's not afraid of, you know, what that looks like, you know, all of the risks that come with it, which are very, very statistically insignificant, I guess you would say. But I really think that if you're going to ask about like preparing, how are you going to prepare, and who are you going to ask, and is a home birth a good option? I totally think that anybody would be far more successful at home than they would in a hospital, unless they had somebody who really, really believed in them, and that would really give them that trial of labor, if that makes sense.
And so with the trial of labor after cesarean, that TOLAC, TOLAC, the trial and the part, it's really like the whole labor leading up to the birth, right? Is, are we going to have it vaginally, or are we going to have it cesarean? Is the reason why some of the practitioners are not supportive of this, or are fearful and don't want to kind of take this on, due to these small risks of things like uterine rupture? Or what do you think it is?
I think so. I think that, you know, VBAC, when you think of the term VBAC, or you think of like that trial, or that somebody has had a prior C-section, a lot of people kind of group it into like the breech births and twin births. And it's kind of like this abnormal thing where if you find a provider who doesn't think it's abnormal and it's totally normal, like it, for me, a VBAC is a totally normal vaginal birth. And so it's like, I think people, a lot of providers or practitioners look at the term VBAC and it kind of scares them. And when that fear presents itself and you have a provider who just kind of wants to opt out of like having any kind of intervention or any kind of just like a uterine rupture, they don't want to have to deal with anything like that, even though it's such a small risk, they're going to steer you in a different direction. And so I think a lot of it is fear. I think people look at VBACs and they're like, oh my gosh, like this could be a huge emergent thing. And while the risk of, you know, having a uterine rupture, which I don't really like saying rupture anyway, because I don't know, you think of rupture and you think of like, I don't know, like this huge emergent thing, right? Something like exploding.
Yes.
Yeah. You think of like a balloon exploding, or like you're driving down the freeway and a tire is like completely blown out. Like that's what I think when I think of rupture. Like that doesn't really, I mean, it can happen, but it's so rare that that's the way that it happens. If you have like a uterine rupture, oftentimes it's something that's like, it's almost like the scar separates. So I like to think of it as like a separation, and it's like a gradual separation, as opposed to it like being this huge catastrophic thing. So I think a lot of practitioners look at it and they're just scared. And I think that's where we have problems when it comes to, moms who want to have that trial of labor. And, you know, you think about like the VBAC success rate in the nation is like 13%. And so that's like super like minimal, like that's so small. That's such a small amount. And so you think about it, that's like 87% of women in the nation that are convinced to have another cesarean or even choose a repeat cesarean. And like, that's a huge number, right? So those numbers are for the hospital. When you think of VBAC outside of the hospital and in like a home birth setting, there is over a 90% success rate. So I'm kind of like, well, I don't know. I just kind of believe that you have to find somebody who's not afraid of it, who's going to take you on, and who's going to believe that you can do it. So,
yeah, because if they are going to project their fear on you and want to meddle and, you know, poke and prod and change things, I mean, I think there's a lot that goes into it for a woman who's doing this trial of labor after cesarean, depending on why her first cesarean happened. Of course, like if she did labor and maybe ended in kind of that classic first time, it was long, it was hard, she got an epidural, needed some Pitocin, baby wasn't coming down, it had been lots of hours, and you know, now baby's heart rate's starting to go down and they're like, oh, baby's not handling this very well. And, you know, you've been pushing and it's just not happening. I think we need to do a cesarean. I mean, that's such a common story, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in those settings, or maybe in the setting of that kind of vibe, but then now something feels really scary and baby's heart rate has completely tanked and now it's an emergency cesarean. This woman now who's growing this baby and is going to go into birth, advocating for herself to have a vaginal birth, is going to have to, on her end of things, her own sort of, you know, story with this.
Doubt. Or
fears, doubt. That's the right word, doubt. Mm-hmm. And kind of like, oh man, like, can
my
I do this?
My body didn't do it the first time.
Yes.
And so like, it makes me think that my body is going to do it the second time. So yep. When you go into this and you have somebody who doesn't believe in you in the first place, like that is just a double, you know, like you need somebody who's going to be like, hey, listen, like I'm not scared of this. And this doesn't mean that you can't have a normal vaginal delivery. And I believe that you can do it.
Yeah. And I have the expertise, like you, this mm-hmm. is me, you saying this, I have the expertise to sit back and watch you. And I'm watching for the warning signs. Mm-hmm. So you can comfortably get in the zone, get comfortable, move around, work with your baby, deeply believe. And also the difference about midwifery care often, some OBs do this as well. I'm not sure to say that none of them do, but I feel like this is always an integrated part of midwifery practices, is these long prenatal appointments where there is a lot of conversation around, how were your previous births? How did that go for you? What did you feel like? What are some of the fears you have? What's coming up for you? What's coming up for your partner? Because your partner's projections matter totally. A ton. You
or
know,
family, so, even like yes, whether they're there family. Or not.
Yes.
Like just hearing it from your family, oh my gosh, you're doing this. Like that's a huge thing too. So there's a lot of conversation and education about like the mental side of things.
Yes, because you feel like you're putting your baby at risk and people are like, why would you do that? Like, why would you, like, what if something happens? You'll never forget for yourself. You'll never da 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 da. And for some reason, people never have that kind of attitude about it when people do choose hospital birth, which is so interesting because I think I understand, because there is in the hospital this medical technology side of things where like we could maybe more quickly save a baby that was like on the precipice of dying. But here's the thing about when you're at home and you are outside of the situation where women are put in scenarios where their babies are on the precipice of dying, it's a really difficult way to look at things. And obviously there are always extenuating circumstances. And I'm just going to say that because I feel like our listeners know that and they should know that, but I don't want anybody to come at this and be like, well, this happened to me and then blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, I get it. You know what? There's a lot of different stories. We'll never have a crystal ball to know exactly what happened or what caused a particular outcome of anyone's birth. But when we have a mentally supportive, emotionally supportive, and then in the physical moment of giving birth, holding space type supportive person as our care provider that we feel so deeply trusting of, that we can go into our internal world and block everything out. And we're not going to be poked and prodded. We're not going to be pressured. We're not going to be told little or, you know, sown those seeds of doubt throughout the whole thing of, well, you know, I don't know, you're getting to be 41 weeks. So we should really schedule that induction. Oh, well, you know, I don't know. You know, your body just might not go back into labor again. You know, well, because of this and da 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 da. Like, we'll see, or whatever it is. And it's like this, there's this power differential sometimes with practitioners. And then there's all these different dynamics that people can be working with that. Really, we are humans. We are so smart. We're cognitive. We think about things. We mold them over. They have subconscious imprints on our soul and in our minds. And it can just feel like you're being set up for failure. Mm-hmm. When if we just set up the situation for success, like we can see with that really extreme statistic of almost like a 90% success rate of home birth after cesarean, well, what is happening there? These people have fewer medical tools at their disposal. And maybe, what a thought, that's a good thing.
Yeah, we're not scared. Well, yeah. It depends on who you talk to, I guess.
Yeah. And then, you know, here's the thing about midwives is because I don't know if you feel this. I don't want to put words in your mouth. This is my projection, I think, of midwives, because naturopathic doctors like myself are sort of up against the AMA and the American Medical Association and being compared to MDs all the time. And if we mess up, God forbid, you know, we just get absolutely hounded and like canceled. Mm-hmm. If we ever mess up in any situation, which isn't common because there's not like that much damage. You know, it's not like we're doing crazy surgeries or things like that. But we have to be really careful in that way. I feel like midwives are the same, because if a midwife makes a mistake, if there's a home birth death, if there's a home birth complication or whatever, it's just like all over the news. It's all over everywhere. It's like midwives just get slaughtered across the board. It's like this happens in hospitals all of the time.
Yeah.
It's a very, very unfair thing.
Totally. They don't see the great births, right? The tons of like amazing births in between the couple of hospital transfers. And I think that's where it's like, okay, like it's really hard, but like oftentimes midwives don't let any emergency or anything get to a point where it's a true emergency. So
because
we're trained to really like look at those things and say, hey, like this is kind of, Here's a pink flag before it turns into this crazy red flag. Like we're going to do something before then.
Exactly.
So it never gets to that point. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that people don't really get that. They don't really know that. They kind of feel like birth is this really wild thing that has no patterns, and that all of a sudden it can just quickly turn into, you know, you have 30 seconds before people are dying or whatever. And it's like, that's just not I mean, obviously things can happen, and like there are cord anomalies or there's unknown reasons for stillbirth, or, you know, and that happens in the hospital again as well. And it's like, nobody could have done anything about it. It is a freak accident thing. And that is true of everything about life. But I think that what people don't realize about midwives is that you guys are constantly monitoring and watching, such a watchful eye and so much attention on this particular client in front of you. And woman and their baby and their story, and you know them so well, and you know everything because you've taken the time to get to know them for those 9 months. And if there's things that are starting to go a little south, or it's, you're just like really, you know, leaning into that intuition too, and this doesn't really seem like it's going to probably happen at home, I think that we should probably get ready to go to the hospital. You know?
That's a good point too. Like, I mean, when you're talking about that, if you're talking about, I mean, because hospital providers can say the same thing. They could say, well, we're monitoring too. We have this constant fetal monitor on. We have all of it. Like, we have nurses in and out. We have a ton of people, right? There's a different aspect of things when you're in midwifery care. Like, you're constantly under, like, when you're in the hospital, yes, you have a like constant fetal monitor, you're constantly monitoring your baby, they have constant like people coming in and out of your room. But what is the like emotional and mental aspect look like, right? Because those are huge things in birth, right? Like when you talk about your labor and birth and having a baby and having this transformational experience, what about those things? Because if you have somebody who doesn't know who you are, who has seen you maybe like, I don't know, maybe a couple times for 10 minutes each time, like that's a huge deal. Like you need somebody who's going to really, really know who you are, what your norms are, what your baseline is, what your baby's baseline is, like what stresses you out, what, you know, what things you have mentally going on, what stressors you have in your life. Like those are all really, really important. And to go into like the VBAC, like if we're going to talk about VBACs, this is also a really important thing that I feel like, for example, if we have a VBAC client, we have to know that physiologically that body is going to maybe have a different labor. And we know that VBAC labors are a little different, or TOLAC labors are a little different, right? Because we know that this body is so smart and it has a scar on the uterus, and it's going to probably have maybe a longer labor, or it might, this body might protect that scar so much that maybe the contractions aren't as strong, or maybe there are bigger breaks in between contractions. Whereas in the hospital, it's just going to be like, well, failure to progress. Or you're not moving as fast, or this is not by the book, right? The book says that you have to have contractions every couple of minutes for this long. And that's not how it works. Everybody's an individual. This is a VBAC birth. We sit in a space where it's like, we're going to take the time and we have the patience to watch over this person and this baby and know that their body is giving them exactly what they need in order to have this baby, right? And so that scar is protected. And so that prior cesarean that was protected, right? And so a lot of people go into VBAC like not even considering that at all too.
Wow, that is really interesting. I didn't ever think about that. So you're seeing that in your home birth TOLACs that end in HBAC, right? Home birth after cesarean, that their births can be a little on that like different side of things.
They're different. Yeah. The Tolak Burks are different because their bodies are just like so incredible in a way that it's like, we're going to protect that scar. So maybe the contractions aren't as strong, or maybe they're not as long, or maybe we're going to have more breaks in between because you just, their body needs that. It's a different birth, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, we see that all the time, and we sit and we honor that instead of looking at it and saying, this isn't normal. This isn't by the book. And like, failure to progress. And that's often what happens. And that's why we have a 13% success rate in the hospital.
Wow. That is so low and so disheartening to hear
really
about.
Sad. 90% at home. Yeah. Come on over.
Right. Well, and this is the idea too of like the idea of a VBAC tolerant provider versus VBAC supportive. Mm-hmm. And tolerance, right? Like, what does tolerance mean? It means that, like, you're accepting bare minimum. You're like, I guess I tolerate that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Versus being supportive and going above and beyond and understanding these depths and these little nuances. And then also, of course, having, if a provider is fearful of VBAC, they're probably going to have less that actually go into being true VBACs. So they're going to have less experience with that. This is the whole problem with breach and twins as well, is that nobody knows how to do it anymore. And so it's very, very scary. And because the providers don't know what they're doing. I mean, it makes sense that it is can be scary because if they get freaked out, they kind of panic, they start doing weird stuff. It doesn't seem like a variation of normal to them. Same thing with wanting to choose a provider who is extremely comfortable with, has lots of experience with, and is supportive of VBAC births. And if you're planning a home birth, for it to be, you know, that they've got a lot of reps and deep confidence in the woman's body for home birth after cesarean as well. And that kind of seems like it's your main tip. Is there anything else that you think that women should be aware of or know about if you are planning on, you know, preparing for an HVAC?
Yeah. So again, it's like majorly mental, I would say. So like, if I'm talking about like preparing for an HVAC, it's like, again, mental preparation. We talked about how you are probably already going into this birth thinking my body is a failure, or my body didn't do it before and is it going to do it again kind of thing. So it's hugely a mental thing. Again, finding a provider that's going to mentally and emotionally support you and really just trust you and your body. And again, I would talk about like the legal side of things. I would really look into like, if you want to have a home birth, the like what your laws are, where you're at, because every state has a different law as far as what you can and can't, what providers or practitioners can or can't do as far as caring for somebody who has potentially had a cesarean before. So like, for example, in the state of Idaho, we are regulated by a law. It's a midwifery law, and the law states what we can and can't do, meds we can and can't administer, procedures we can and can't do. And so we can care for somebody who has had a prior cesarean before, as long as they've only had one prior cesarean before, as long as they're what's called a pregnancy interval. So the time that they had their cesarean to the time that they have their next baby is 18 months. And as long as they haven't had a prior classical scar, and that classical scar means that it is a scar that doesn't like go through the fundus, which is the top of the uterus. So it has to be like a lower cesarean scar, if that makes sense. So those are like the laws in Idaho. It's different everywhere. So you would definitely have to look into the laws that either your midwives or even like hospital providers. Some hospitals, what I'm hearing and understanding is some hospitals around the country won't even consider a VBAC. So definitely something to look into depending on where you're at.
Yeah. And I think that that's kind of on par with the overall, if that's the vibe of the hospital nearest you, there's no other options in terms of hospital birth, this would be something it would behoove you to look into a birth center or a home birth if it's possible in your state, because that I feel like is a telling sign of how archaic those hospitals' policies are and not in line with research or best interests of the woman.
Totally.
I think everybody agrees, ACOG included, that it is in the best interest of the woman and the baby to be born vaginally if that's possible. And it is less risky overall, because now if a woman is has two, three, say she wants to have six kids, something like that. You're getting into a scary situation here because the compounding effects of all of those cesareans add up on each other. I did not know this about Idaho that you just said, that you can only do an HVAC if you've had one prior cesarean. So you can't be a VBAC.
Yeah. So if you've had two prior cesareans, then you are not allowed to have an HVAC. So you have to, I mean, if you want to, I don't even know what the hospital policies are on that. I don't know if they just automatically jump to an automatic cesarean for your third labor and birth. But you can't have an out of hospital birth if you've already had two prior cesareans. So you can have one, but not two.
Not two. Do you think that's, I understand with the scar rule that, you know, having the vertical scar or a scar that's high that goes up through the fundus, that makes sense to me that that would not be a good idea because the fundus is where all of this strength from this uterus is coming from, and it's where the pushing is going to happen and everything. And if you're going to have a rupture and if it's up there, it's probably a lot more likely up there. So that to me makes sense. Do you think that the, in your experience, that the two VBAC prior rule is valid, or what do you think?
So there has been research done that shows that if you've had two prior cesareans before, the statistics on if you were to have like a rupture or anything like that, it's really a very, very small percentage compared to one cesarean. So it's very, very close to having, it's very similar. So the statistical evidence is very, very minute as far as like the difference between having one and two. So I personally, like if there was no law, I personally would take somebody who has had two prior cesareans. I don't think it's a huge risk. However, if you're talking about like VBACs, like so VB3 or 4 Cs, they just haven't done very much research on that. So it's like they don't do research on anything like that because they just jumped to having another cesarean, right? So there's no research on it. So I can't really say, but as far as like the one and two, we've seen so many people who have had two prior cesareans who want to have other babies, who potentially want to have babies at home, which I totally would be on board for, because technically the statistics aren't super significant as far as the difference between one and two and the increased risk of having like a huge like uterine rupture or rupture or separation or anything like that. So I personally would feel comfortable with it. Again, it depends on the law in whatever state you're in, and it depends on who you're really talking to. So
I think that the takeaway here is that finding somebody who has a deep belief in women and the body and birth and physiology, and that VBAC can be a variation of normal, and that things will be a little bit different, and to respect that, honor it, hold space for it, and be still supportive, you know, until there's a moment of otherwise, until something, of course, like just with every birth, if we need to pivot, then we need to pivot. But
this, and those are conversations you have prenatally. And so like, you know, you trust whoever you're like, have, you know, hired as your provider, that you've talked about these things and you feel comfortable with these things. And so honestly, like as far as VBAC, the evidence is clear, like including like there's level A evidence in ACOG that VBAC is a reasonable choice for anybody who has had a prior cesarean. So
I love that. I think that's really awesome. And you know, there's certain women who have been told that their pelvises are too small, they can never have a vaginal birth, whatever. I just think that not to say that it's never possible, but that is not a common thing. That is not like, oh, some people are just born this way. Like, and it's, you know, what of like, they almost make it sound like it's maybe, you know, like 20% of women are just making these babies that are way too big to come out of their body, or that their pelvis is way too small. And it just, I think it comes from that historical, you know, back in the day when women had low vitamin D levels and during puberty and they had rickets and then their pelvises were actually misformed and or malformed. And that is just not what's happening today. It is so, so, so rare for that to be the case. Oftentimes, if this is what women are being told, it's really the failure to wait and be patient on the side of the practitioner. Plus, it is harder for babies to navigate when women are not upright and moving. And this is one of the problems of, you know, hospital systems and the lack of pain management that they offer that's not pharmaceutical. And you know, then now women are walking around with this deep belief that their bodies are broken or different. It's always going to be their story.
Yeah. And we have to think too, like when you think that you had your first baby as a cesarean, you've really never had a vaginal birth before. So you have to expect that potentially, like, this is like having a first baby again. Your baby has never traveled through those tissues before. It's like a primate birth, right? You've never had a baby travel in that direction before. So it's really natural that your body is just like accommodating and opening and like just, it's like a first time mom birth, right?
It's going to take longer. So, your cervix so you hasn't have been to be dilated. Patient.
Yep. Yeah, totally.
Totally. Okay. Thank you so much for this. I think this is awesome. I just really want people to hear what it's like, what VBAC is, what it means to people in this setting of being very, very pro-physiological birth supportive from, you know, the OB side with Dr. Kapsanakis, with you, Julianne, as a midwife, and with our doula and birth educator care. I really appreciate all your voices in this conversation to, you know, help empower and inspire and start conversations with people who are maybe in this boat and they're wanting something different and they're not really exactly sure, or they're not finding those people who are supportive yet. And so they don't really think they exist, but they do. And you need to keep looking.
Yep. Yep. Well, thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for coming on. And now for the interview with doula Care Messer. Okay, so on the podcast today, we have Care Messer, who, I mean, I just really can't speak your praises enough. You are a saint in my eyes, a birth saint, and also just a very good friend.
You're hardly a saint.
You are. And I want to tell the listeners who you are in case they don't know, because you have just – you've been absolutely pivotal, seriously, like without getting emotional, you've been pivotal in my experience of birth and motherhood in general, and especially in kind of just continuing to light the flame underneath my booty of what's important, how can women have these experiences, feel better about the way that everything goes with their birth, and just being also connected to other women. So let me read your bio here for a second, and then we'll start talking about VBAC. So Care is the founder of the Birth Education Center. When Care discovered hypnobirthing for the birth of her daughter in 2008, it changed her life's path. Care believes that babies can experience a birthday that is magical, loving, and gentle. When families are educated to resolve fears, birth becomes a beautiful, positive experience. Woot woot to that. Care continued on to become a donor-certified doula and became a certified hypnobirthing instructor. From there, Care started her own business, the San Diego Hypnobirthing, where she has been educating families since 2009. You are also so many other things, which is a NATH hypnotherapist, a certified placenta encapsulationist, an erotic blueprint coach, childbirth educator, CA, PPA trained postpartum doula, innate tradition certified postpartum doula. You have so many different trainings. You added a holistic doula certification with the Matrona, which anyone knows about WAPIO and the Matrona. That's amazing.
She's amazing.
She is amazing. She's one of those like just – it's going to be a really, really sad, bad day when she leaves this earth, but she's a really awesome, amazing.
Not for heaven. They'll be stoked to get her back.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. And then you serve as the director of the CAP Wellness Center, if anyone knows. And also Dr. Kapsanakis is the OBGYN that we had on the other, the piece before this on the podcast to discuss VBAC from his perspective.
He's and fantastic too.
Yes, he sure is. And you're a mentor and educator for doulas across San Diego County, and you teach professional doula classes created for the Birth Education Center. And you have an absolutely rippling effect that, you know, again, it's just had such an impression on me. And your Birth Education Center based hypnobirthing class that's online too. If anyone lives in the San Diego area, 100% hightail it up to the Birth Education Center and take it in person. But if you can,
We don't have it in person right now.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Good correction.
All online. Okay. And I highly recommend it. Wes and I took it when it was in person. This was back in 2015 though. And you're so unique because you're like also a comedian.
I do make fun of vaginas a lot and penises. Yes. But if you don't laugh about how silly the whole thing is, you can't stay focused in birth class. It's silly.
It is silly. And I think you're so engaging for the partners too, because it's not just this dry, like, or super serious, like where everybody has to be taking this, like, I don't know, inauthentic kind of serious tone about the whole thing. You're very, you know, your words always were rippling through my mind during my birth of my floppy manta ray vagina, keeping everything super floppy down there, which is so true. And it was so hard for me to relax because when you have this big bulging thing coming through that area, that's never happened before.
It takes focus and you have to think Barbie head, Manta ray vagina. Yeah, it is. It's a visual, because once you see a little G.I. Joe head, you're like, oh, my vagina is vast. It's enormous. It's expansive. It does. It makes a huge difference. And it makes a difference for VBACs too.
Yes. Okay. And so I want you to kind of tell us, as with all of the experience that you have as a doula and a birth educator, and all of the women that have you've touched their births in the positive way that you have, what would sort of be the top tips that you would give someone who's preparing to have a VBAC, who's pregnant now? I mean, this could be for birth in general as well. And I'm sure that a lot of these tips will span multiple different situations. But I just kind of wanted you to flow and give us, you know, the best that you got, because you have so much experience in this realm.
Well, I think first, thank you for letting me show your birth, your very first birth with Gabe in my classes.
Yes.
Because everybody gets to see your nipples when they're in my class. And it's just... And I think I've seen that birth more than you have, because yes. I see it in every series. So just so you know, I have Gabe's birth completely memorized. There's so many tips when it comes to VBAC, but in general, the whole object of not having to worry about a VBAC is prevention. And as you're listening to this, you may be, you know, working towards a VBAC, but send this to somebody who is not pregnant yet. Because prevention is number one. And one of the things that the very first online course that I created actually is a thank you to the birth community for all that they've done to support me and my girls is how to avoid an unnecessary cesarean class. It is free. It's free for everybody. It's an hour long, but it goes through the steps of how to really hedge your bets and understand the birth process. And when families connect with me early, before they're even pregnant, we can put that spiritual connection element in, that it's not your baby's, or it's not your birth, it's your baby's birth.
Mm.
And this baby is coming to you because they chose you. You guys have chosen each other. You're there to learn with each other. And you don't have the full weight of it. You have the weight of the labor, but your baby's working equally as hard to be born. And they're learning new pathways while they're in your belly. So it's such a bigger perspective than we've been taught on those stupid TVs our whole life. And the birth education we come in to class with is all Hollywood media crap. And yeah. It's fear-based. And we don't believe in our bodies before we get into birth class. We need to start that earlier. So prevention is number one for the new people. And we've got to get them before they're even pregnant. I want to talk to them before they're pregnant.
Yeah, that would be, I mean, agreed. From a naturopathic doctor perspective, it's always something that would be best if people were doing some preconception health things, you know, before they've even decided that they were going to begin trying to conceive, because then we could get into the best position possible. And yeah, thinking about these things ahead of time, it's not just, oh, how do I get pregnant? How do I prepare my body? It's, yeah, what is the birth going to look like? And of course, when you're pregnant, it becomes a little bit more real, and maybe people will be more motivated then. But there's a lot to learn. If you've never looked into this world, there's a lot of unlearning.
Oh, so much.
And then learning. And so we're definitely going to put your free preventing cesarean course in the show notes, so if anyone can take that and access that, because that is key. And sometimes there's unavoidable situations, of course, as you know, like, you know, with a breech or something where you live in a state where nobody will do it vaginally. So you have to have a breech cesarean or whatever, but there is so many more situations where that first or primary, it's called, if it's your first baby, primary cesarean could have been prevented. And that maybe that's because we don't need an induction, or maybe that's because,
oh, please. Can we please?
Yes. Please go.
If you want, if you want to know from birth workers' perspective, the thing that is increasing the risk of cesarean more than anything else is the induction talk. Mm-hmm. And you are groomed from the time you come in that your baby is too big at 15 weeks all the way on.
Insane.
Of, you know, if we at our practice, we only let our moms go to 40 weeks, or we encourage at 39 weeks, whatever it is. You have to start trusting your body. If you can bake a baby, you can birth a baby.
Yes.
If birth was so inherently never going to work, this planet would have 10 people on it. We have birthed babies from the beginning of time. Like, our bodies know what to do. You have never met a woman who has been pregnant her whole life. It's not a thing. What are we like? Our common sense goes, oh yeah, that's true. But then why are we listening to the patriarchy bullshit? Please don't censor that word out, because it fits right there. From saying your body is broken, it's not going to work. If you don't go into labor, we will have to. who doesn't go into labor? Give my baby time to be done.
Yeah.
They know their timeline better than anybody else. So induction, and there are small cases where induction is needed. But just so you know, all of your friends that have been induced, most of those were elective. They agreed to them. It was a suspected maybe medical thing or a time thing or whatever. They were elective. You're forcing your body to do something it's not ready to do. And that leads to a lot of extra interventions that can get you into the place that you didn't want to go in the first place. And when you don't get yourself educated because you're scared of that, you're getting yourself into that place.
Yeah. This is something that I wish everyone just really, really knew as a truth, just in the way that they know that, I don't know, the grass is green, which is that the body birthing a baby is not like, I don't even know. I can't even think of an analogy that is so simplified that I think maybe people think it is. It's a very intricate, intelligent, robust, amazing system of hormones and tissue responses and adrenaline and endorphins kind of combating each other in various stages and phases of the birth, and your body moving, and then your baby doing all this stuff. It's a dance. It's not just the woman's body doing it all. Like you said, it's the baby too. And there is a lot that has to happen in order for this to be the, you know, seamless sort of simple process that it could and should be. And if we force it to happen when all of those tissues and everything is not ready, why wouldn't it just always be that clicked secondary thought to say, well, of course there's maybe going to be more issues with that. And yes, do people get induced all the time and they still have a vaginal birth or they still have a baby in their arms? Like, yeah, of course. But if we were to look at all of the statistics and the things around that, the need for the intervention and also just the increased risk, it's undeniable. Completely.
Well, and we may be getting babies out, but 1 in 3 are having birth trauma.
Yeah.
So maybe we are having an induction and a baby's coming out and it's on and we're hearing, oh, well, everyone's healthy. You all lived. Why is that the baseline?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why is that the baseline, right? That's like bare minimum. If we're starting from there, then how do we go back in time to be like, what kind of birth do I want? And what connection do I need in order to trust this? We trust poop to come out of our body. We trust pee to come out of our body. We trust blood to be circulating. We trust our heart to beat. We don't even think about breathing. We've grown a baby with the exact same ease. It's just done its thing. There's been no checkoff list. Do you have hair, you know, hair today? What about those toenails? Have they come in? No one's checking that. But then at the end, we just think, you suck. This isn't going to work.
Yeah, it's not going to work, man.
Right. And it is going to work. So trust in your body and getting education early is so key. And I know you're scared. I know you're like, I'm scared of everything. I don't want to even, but that can easily, once you understand it, you go, oh my gosh, that's pretty cool.
Yes.
And then you start to get confidence in your body. And then you start to meet other people who've done it. And you're like, wow, I don't know. My pain tolerance, like, hey, guess what? You've got these hormones. 200 times more powerful than morphine. You guys, I love morphine. I would mainline that shit. Your body makes it something even better than that, right? You just have to tap into it. And once you have those coping skills, and when you're going for a VBAC, let's talk about those. Because if you haven't learned those things in childbirth education, because you did have your head in the sand, you were scared, things happened and you get to that place where you're having a cesarean, now you're pissed. When we start with the VBAC preparation, the first thing I want you to do after your birth is be pissed. Cry it out. Like, understand that was your experience. Find the therapy you need. Let's work on the emotional part of that. Because if you bury it and say, I'm just not going to do it next time, and you just are aiming at I'm going to have a vaginal birth next time, but you haven't done the work to sort through the emotions, you're just going to repeat it. So when you're the first thing to do is work on the emotional stuff and the physical stuff. At 3 months, get to a pelvic floor therapist and start working on the pelvic floor and the cesarean scar tissue and making amends with your body and saying, thank you for being the sunroof that my baby came out of. It's not the plan, but it worked.
I love that sunroof.
You know, you've got the front door, the sunroof, and you've got to start making amends to heal the emotional parts that can hold you up the next time. Because if you're still fearful, you're still anxious, that can prevent that next birth going the way you want it to go. So getting in touch with the physical stuff and the tissues and waiting 18 months before you get pregnant.
Yeah.
And that's the, we jump on it. We want that do-over birth so quick and we're so angry about it. That's not the way to bring a baby in, because babies feel you from the very moment of conception. And if you're pissed and you're just doing it to get a do-over, that's their entry into your body and into the whole pregnancy process. So if you can wait that 18 months, really get the support emotionally from the therapist, from EMDR therapy, whatever it is that will help you kind of process what happened, it's a better slate for that baby to come in on. And then you start working with that baby to say, whew, what happened last time is not going to happen this time. And I really need you to work with me on this. And also, can you process your birth with your first baby?
Mm.
They went through that same process with you. It was their birth too, right? If it was hard for you, it was hard for them because they were feeling all of your emotions. And they understand that. Like, sit with them, even if they're a newborn, and talk to them and cry with them and say, I was out of control. I felt like this and this was this. And I was even angry at you because I thought, why wouldn't you turn? Like, let that process, because they're working through, they are a bigger spirit or soul than you're giving them credit for, and they are processing it with you.
Okay,
go ahead.
All right, I just want to stop you there for a second. What would that look like? What does that actually mean, do you think, for most people to process the birth of your first child with the baby? Like, are we talking out loud? Are we just doing it in our head? Are we journaling, writing? Are we addressing it to the baby?
I would say both. I would say out loud and in journal writing. I would say also with a therapist. But when your baby is with you, and you can even do it with a craniosacral therapist, because especially a craniosacral trauma therapist, they can show you the movements of the baby of how he or she will ask the baby, how were you born? And the baby will show where they were stuck or where they couldn't move. And
I have seen that before. I know that sounds like shamalama ding dong, woo woo, whatever, but these babies have, it's like an instinctual imprint in their body. There's not that many things they have yet on their body in that sort of a way. And it is fascinating to watch those people work.
And it really also helps the parents process, oh my gosh, this wasn't my fault, or it wasn't baby, you were hung up on that hip, you know, and baby might still have pain in their neck. And this helps them work out. We all carry from conception on in our body. Our body, you know, starts to, like a spiral, grow. And that is our psoas tissue. That's why when people do psoas work, they have these emotional releases, because it has stored our individual life from the very beginning. And so all of those tissues matter when we're processing things. So as you're holding your baby, you're not going to upset them by crying. They need to cry too, right? It's an emotional process, and we don't want those tissues with that stuff stuck. We want it to release. We want that energy to move. It does sound super hippie. It doesn't matter. It's real.
Yeah.
You can sound as hippie as you want. Like, I don't care. It's real.
Yeah.
I was a back labor birth with my mom, who was strapped down to the bed with Pitocin with no drugs.
Oh my gosh.
So you could have gotten enemy secrets from somebody like that, right? And it was back labor. So imagine being wedged with no movement. And I have relived that and felt the trauma that was in my body and was able to release it with craniosacral.
Okay.
I knew where I was stuck. Like, it's still stored. Our tissues store everything.
Right. And this is sort of the body keeps the score. There's a book that's all about this and the where trauma, it's very, you know, it's evidence-based. Again, there's like a lot to this. It's not just woo-woo. I understand that in the realm of infants and newborns, it can feel like, well, how do we know? Da, da, da. But there actually is an entire field called perinatal psychology that is really fascinating with, what's her name? Anna something?
Anna Verwal.
Anna Verwal. I'm going to link her information on the show notes as well, because that's some fascinating information about the way that babies came in, and then even just indicative down to like their personality traits, or, and it, you know, chicken or the egg, but it's like sort of maybe the way that their personality is was the thing that was influencing the way that they participated and at what speed and everything and efficiency during the birth.
And we have so much science that backs all that now. There are perinatal psychologists everywhere that have done so much work in healing grown adults from what happened at birth and repatterning who they came in, what they came into.
Yeah, it matters. It all matters. This is like so important. This is, I know that you feel this, obviously. I'm preaching to the choir here, but this is like, It's one of the most mind-blowing things to me about our modern culture that we don't have more reverence for birth. Like, birth should be the most sacred. I mean, I guess it's one of those signs that, you know, everything in society is crumbling, is how the lack of reverence we have for it, and how, like you said earlier, the tenet is, oh, well, healthy mama, healthy baby, everybody's alive. Cool. Great. It's like, okay, wait a minute. Can we also remember that the United States has one of the very worst maternal morbidity outcomes of any industrialized country? And that shocks people. They don't think I'm telling the truth. They think it's like a conspiracy. It's not a conspiracy. I wish it was.
No, facts.
Yeah, facts.
Facts. And if you go on my website, there's also a free talk that I did with the birth psychology group. And it talks about the loss of connection with birth and death, because those two things are very sacred and they're the exact same thing. You're coming into one life and then you're leaving the life. That transition for the soul is exactly the same. And we don't honor either one of them.
Yeah.
When we lost the honoring of death, now we can really be fearful of birth because we're afraid of death. Wow. So that's the biggest hang over our head, right? Your baby will die if XYZ. And so we do really crazy shit because that's the, you know, and it's like, you know what? When we understand that death is a transition, just like birth is a transition, it's a much different conversation because it's sacred and spiritual. And you take more ownership of the birth process than you would normally because you're so scared of the death part. And I think that's, we increase really our death part because we're so disconnected from the birth part.
Wow. So that's actually really interesting. I know that a lot of birth workers tend to also find themselves at some point into the death work side of things, being like death doulas. If you've never heard of a death doula, that's an interesting line to look into. And yeah, it is. It's because it's the same thing. It's the transition in or out. Wow.
Yeah. And I'm doing that right now with somebody very close to me. And it's, while it's so hard and it's so powerful.
Wow.
The hospice thing. It is. It's kicking my butt, but we're not going to talk about that because then I will cry.
Okay.
Okay. So first thing, prevention. Second thing, reconnect with your body, get the help with your tissues, go to the pelvic floor therapist, process that stuff physically. Start with the good nutrition, all of that. Don't get pregnant. Like, please try your best to keep those 18 months for healing and connecting with the first baby, because a lot of us don't connect because of the trauma. And we feel like bad parents and all of that kind of stuff. And that can be both parents, not just the mom. So really work on that part first so that that part's stable, so that as you get pregnant with the second do-over birth, it's not actually a do-over birth. It's just a different birth.
Yes.
So addressing the trauma is number one. And then what about asking your partner what they experienced during your cesarean? A lot of partners are not very gung-ho on you having a vaginal birth again because of all they witnessed and the trauma that they experienced secondhand. And then that baby was out in 5 minutes. Why would we go through the 26 hours and all of that when we could have the baby out in 26 minutes or 5 minutes? That has to be talked about, because once you came home, it was all about your healing and you overprocessing and talking, and nobody talked to the partner and what they witnessed. And that needs to be addressed before you even get pregnant. Like, some therapy, some talking out, just even asking, how did you experience that? A lot of, especially men, have a hard time saying, I was terrified. I was so scared that you too, something was going to happen to you. I was racing through 25 scenarios of how I was going to handle things, and that I wasn't enough, and that I froze, and that whatever it was. And that needs to be talked about because no one has processed that. This is still the parent for the second child. We don't want secondhand trauma in the room. We want clear energy, and that comes from healing on both parties. And even my mom couples, same thing. They were like, I was absolutely so terrified. And I kept thinking, why am I not the one pregnant? I could handle this differently. You know, so there's secondary guilt that even gets involved. So please ask your partner.
That's such a good point.
And then you're going to process with your baby, obviously. And then look at that birth as an experience that you all had together, a learning experience. Not your favorite, maybe just something you didn't want, even if it wasn't traumatic, but let that go as that experience that you've learned from, that you're going to use those as building blocks for the next one. Because a lot of moms have guilt for wanting to have a better birth or take more initiative for education or getting a better doctor or being aware of what the possibilities could have been on their first. And that holds them back from doing the VBAC.
Yep.
Because they feel guilty. And even along the way, they're like, but how can I want this such something so good when I didn't do anything to prepare? That's why we need to let go of that experience and understand the three of you learned the lessons. We've processed through it. They are fine. We are good. And how do we prevent that from happening again and enjoy that experience, all of us? And if you're doing a home birth, there's an opportunity for that firstborn to be in that room and allow them to process it, and they're energetically healing by watching that happen.
Oh, wow.
So it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And they're repatterning their system by seeing it done the way maybe they wished it would have happened or that it could have happened, but it's a group healing sensation for everybody if you can do it that way.
Wow. I have never thought of that. That is like bringing me to tears to just consider. And of course, it's like, you know, the 2.5-year-old running around the room or whatever is not necessarily consciously having a thought of like, wow, I wish I would have had that. But there's deep imprints happening in their nervous system and the way, you know, even potentially their epigenetics, as we know that thoughts have such an impact there, that can absolutely be such a healing closing loop for them.
Absolutely can.
Wow.
And it's, once again, we have to bring that spiritual connection part because nobody talks about it. There is a feeling in the room with a birth that is unmistakable. And even my atheists have said, I don't know. I'm like, I know it's bigger than we know, but it is there. And when we can connect to it, we're on a deeper level with what's happening to our bodies, to the room, to us energetically, to us as a connection, as a family. And it's a stabilizing influence because it is what it is and it's who we all are. So, and we'll talk about that when we talk about education, when I get into that part. Education. Oh, go ahead. Did you want to say
something? Just really quick. I wanted to say, I'm trying to think of an analogy because like you're saying, people feeling guilty for wanting this other experience with their next baby. And I think some people might be shaking their heads or judging and being quick to judge, to be like, wow, what is it about a vaginal birth that is like you want so bad? Like you're never going to get a trophy and da da da. And it's like, no, hold on. That's literally like a 1% of the entire piece of this experience. It would be like, well, you can have this is still not at all even as impactful and powerful as the birth experience. But let me just like draw a baby minor connection to those people that are having a hard time understanding this. Not in a judging way. I'm just seriously like you. I really want people to be able to rub off the socialization that they have on their glasses so they can see what this is for what it is. But like, let's just pretend you can go and you can have a beautiful wedding where it's one of the best days of your life and you have all your friends and family and everybody's speaking highly of you and you are able to declare your love for your partner in front of all your most famous or not famous, but most important people in your life. Or you can just go to the courthouse. You can just go to the courthouse and you can just do it and not have like literally no experience around it. Not to say that cesareans are going to the courthouse and like that it doesn't, you know, that they're choosing that and that they're wanting, it's just that you can have it's not just going and having a marriage certificate. Like a vaginal birth and having this experience is not just getting a baby out. There is an entire process. There's a rite of passage, I think, for mothers in entering this huge, very important lifelong phase of your life now where you are caring for and raising this baby. And like the way that you are able to participate in and really deeply believe in, embody, feel empowered in this entire experience, like it can have lasting effects that change your life forever. Like it's not just having a baby in your arms. It's so much more than that. And so it's not just that these women are like, they want to have the experience of pushing a baby out their vagina. It's like, that's not it. Like that is one teeny tiny piece of this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and because, I know what I mean. why do we want an expansive floppy vagina? Like it's not that. It's like, oh, I want to see how big I can get. It's not that. How erect can my vagina get? It is not that. It is the process of coming into motherhood, coming into parenting. And a lot of times we need that really shitty birth to go, oh my gosh, I never realized that they took all my power away. I didn't realize that I had that kind of power. I didn't realize that I allowed it to happen because I didn't get educated. I turned it all over to them. And then you're mad at yourself, but you didn't even know you had that power to begin with. So how can you be mad at yourself? Because we have stripped you of your power. All of our power has been stripped from the time we were little because of society, those glasses of society, right? We have trained you that when a bell rings, it's lunchtime. That's factory worker programming. We have trained you that doctors, principals, teachers, everyone has authority over you. You have no say in who you are, or even, I didn't know what my favorite color was till I was 32. Because my mom told me it was purple. So I just believed it. It was purple. And my friend goes, you wear pink all the time. I'm like, yeah, but my favorite color is purple. She's like,
You sure about that?
Yeah. And I was like, you're right. And I like glitter. And she's like, yeah, I'm going to give you permission to pick your own color. I didn't even realize that that was a thing. Like no clue, right? So there are little bits that we are conditioned responses and societal norms of how we should be. And it's that first crappy birth that makes us go, oh my gosh, now I know a little bit more of who I am. Yeah. That's what we want with the do-over birth. We want to take that power back because, and with education, with a doula, with whatever, we're not empowering you with that. You are already empowered. You can call all the shots. You just might not know it. It's the doula and the education and the right provider that can remind you of that. You are already 100% empowered. You can make every choice you want to make. You can say, fuck it to the system. You can say, I love the system. I want to go with that. It's all up to you. But when you turn it over to other people, that's sometimes the reminder you need is the consequences of those choices to remind you that, oh my gosh, things can be different. So yeah, it's not the floppy vagina. That's not why we're doing it.
Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. It's the empowered feeling embodied and having that control and the choice. Like Leah, so my co-host on this podcast, had a cesarean with her first and her, and it was like, you know, there's lots of different things that go into the way that the birth went. But at the end of it though, because she was an active participant in the choice to have a cesarean, it wasn't a, you know, thankfully it was not an emergent. It was not a scary situation. She, her overall experience, this is just to like offer an alternative perspective, right, on this, but like in line with what you're saying, she had like in her perception, she had a great birth. Like she really felt like, yeah, did it go the way she wanted? No. She's able to hold both and in her mind at the same time, which is, did I get the home birth that I was wanting and preparing for? No. And at the same time, I didn't feel scared. I didn't feel bullied. I didn't feel disempowered. I felt actually empowered because I was making the choice on the way that this was going to go. And I was heard and she was given the most amazing, beautiful, informed consent at San Diego, at a Scripps Encinitas that I've ever seen in my life. I wish I knew the OBGYN's name so I could tell you. But either way, it was so great. And she was like respected. And, you know, that is a whole big piece of this entire thing that we carry in our bones and in our tissues for the rest of our lives. These imprints of these moments are huge. And if we are treated in a way that makes us feel small and dumb and unprepared and unworthy, and maybe even like supports other beliefs that we've had carrying around in our lives from our other childhood traumas or whatever, that we don't get to have, like, who are you to have a good life? Or like, why would you get to have that or whatever? Like these things can be supportive or crumbling of those kinds of ideologies. And it can really shift and our trajectory of our entire life and our belief system. So, okay. I want you to touch on education because I know that you have lots of that for resources, but also obviously in your experience of this, this is one of the main pivotal things that people can do in order to prepare for having a successful VBAC.
Absolutely. And there's a thing with education that, especially if you, because I want you to change up your venue. I want you to get a different doctor. I want you to do all those things. We'll talk about that. But there are things that will come up in a second birth because you've done it before, whether that was going to be a vaginal or labor or whatever, that can be activating in your system. And those activating things need to be prepared for and planned for so that you have a course of action to take if that comes up. For example, you know, if I hear, oh my gosh, you're just not dilating, you know, we might want to start a little light thing of Pitocin or whatever the phrase may be, right? We're going to first try and prevent that phrase from ever taking place. If you're going to talk Pitocin, please talk to my partner in the hall about it. Then you never hear about it, right? That's great. You want to talk about it out of my earshot. Or maybe your mother-in-law showed up last time and it pissed you off because you didn't invite anybody. So this time we're going to prevent that from happening. So you're going to try and make these fail-safe things for, you know, what really hurt me last time was this word was used. You weren't there for me with this. And I know you tried, but it was this. Like, have the hard conversations so that those don't show up. That's the first part of education. Listing down what were your worst moments, weakest moments, scariest moments, less disempowered moments, and then how are we going to hedge those bets? Where are we going to put good things in place that if that happens, I have a plan of action? That's all we need. And then you put that, sometimes it's just, I'm going to breathe five times. I'm going to put my Bucky 40 blinks on. I'm going to recenter myself. I want my music playing and I want that nurse out of the room. whatever it is. But those breaths, those five breaths, tell your nervous system, no tigers are here. You're absolutely okay. It's a little reset. So that's the first part of education. The next is, especially if you didn't have childbirth education the first time, interview childbirth educators. Find the ones that are going to give you your birth basics and also the connection that you need to build a team. Also the advocacy that you need to speak up for yourself. And I'm going to refer you to Doula Tracy for advocacy, because she is one of the leading experts on finding your voice and finding where you felt disenfranchised, disempowered on that first birth so that you don't let that happen again. And she gives you fail-safe ways to do that. It's her trainings are amazing. And she has one for parents. She has one for doulas. I'm actually hosting her training in October here in San Diego because our community needs advocacy training so much, because as birth workers, we let things slide because of our training that can actually harm our families. And it's important that all of us are on the same page with that. So when you're interviewing childbirth educators, and I want you to interview them because every teacher's different. I'm not the right person for everybody. I'm too sacrilegious for a lot of people. I'm cool with that. Find your person. You know, there are Christian educators. There are very by the book educators. There are super scientific ones. There are, and all there's different methods. There's Lamaze. There's hypnobirthing. There's so many, right? But you have to find what resonates with you. And I want you to find that early, because there's stuff you can do to practice. I have families that don't actually start my class until a month and a half, 2 months before, but they contact me before they're pregnant. And we start on meditations and we start on fear releasing and we start on having conversations with our partners and building a team. Educators know all that stuff. Connect with them and then hire your doula early. Please get a doula. Please get a doula.
Yeah, I second that. Please get a doula. Please get a doula.
Yeah. And one that is the same way, very good at advocating for what level you want of that and have those conversations. Not all doulas advocate. A lot of doulas, we were trained not to. We were trained to just keep your mouth shut and let them do it. I can't sit by in a birth and watch someone treat another person in an inhumane way. Can't do it. Won't do it. I will do it at the risk of getting kicked out, but they don't kick you out. You're there to say, hey, let's work together. We're working as a team. We're not there to cause an obstinate behavior. So definitely when you're talking to your doula, how do you advocate? What do you do? Because if they're not comfortable with that, it might not be the person for you. And it might be because you want to do the advocating. That's cool too. But have that conversation. But doulas need to connect with you on an emotional and personal level, as well as, are they educated enough? A brand new doula might not be the doula for a VBAC. You want them to really understand the system. You want them to understand how we got there the first time and be able to have those educated conversations, not only scientifically, but also emotional IQ within the room. So, and yes, there are some doulas who are really good doulas and have never had a VBAC. They're still experienced doulas. They've never attended a VBAC. You might be their first VBAC, but they're experienced doulas. So that's a difference too, right?
Love that.
But I also would encourage you to change things up. If you have, and this is privileged, if you have the opportunity to change hospitals, do a home birth, do a birth center if you can, if they support you back, change that up so it doesn't smell the same. It doesn't look the same. It doesn't remind you and activate those parts that made you feel disempowered. Really get in your head, this is a new baby, a new birth, and a new experience. Mm-hmm. How am I connected to them? What conversations am I having with them? What am I doing different than I did the last time with no guilt? Because second babies too, you guys, second babies know they're the second baby. They know that the first baby's going to get most of the therapy. They know that they're sliding in on rules that you've already practiced and tried and true on the first one. Like, they're smart. They should come in a second because they're like, yeah, everything's being way easier. You've seen those TikToks on first, second, third babies. Like, they're different. Okay. And every parent can attest to that. I also want you to understand that because this is your second baby, your body can birth like it's your second baby.
Okay. Yes. And you and I were just talking about this before we started recording, and I did not know this. And I have erroneously been telling people that if they've had a first primary cesarean, like in a situation where they never had labor, maybe it was breech or something, that their VBAC will be almost more like a first time mom experience, in that like first time dilation and it might be long and rah, 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 but you don't mm-hmm. experience that. So tell us about that.
So I'll tell you two things that come up in birth. The first one is, even midwives will say to a first-time mom, you know, first babies, they take a long time. It's going to be at least 24 hours. You may have weeks of prodromal, whatever the bullshit that comes out. They post that on a first-time parent, and we are so in our mind to protect ourselves that we're sucking in all this information, and now we're hearing it from an authority that birth's going to be 200 years long. So we create a 200-year-long birth because we're a first-time mom. Not true. I see first time people having 6-hour births all the time, 9 hours, 8 hours, because they don't listen to that. So let's rephrase that. Please don't put on somebody what their story is going to be. Let them create what they want with their baby. Average births in the world are 8 to 12 hours. How come in America they're 24? That's bullshit. Okay. So let's call the bullshit meter on that. The second is, obviously, it makes sense. They never went into labor their first time, so their body hasn't dilated, so whatever. However, they have the hormonal blueprint of growing a baby. So you're doing the exact same thing. Got pregnant, you're growing a baby the whole time, 10 months. Your body goes, oh yeah, kick it out. Just because you haven't dilated, you haven't been in labor, or you got to 8 centimeters and nothing else happened, your body still remembers. It's still going to move forward, and it moves forward at a faster pace because it's done it before. So I see second time VBACs. One of my friends just had, one of her doula clients had a VBAC in 2.5 hours, like a second timer. You know, like, we never know. Sometimes they don't make it to the hospital. Yay. I love car birth because it says automobile on your birth certificate. But
no way, it does.
It does. It says automobile. Isn't that cool? I was like, I had one family who were birthed in front of Scripps La Jolla, but it was still automobile on their birth certificate. And when I got there, they were hosing off. I was there to pick up the plenum. They were hosing off the concrete because, you know, stuff. Yeah. And if you have a baby in the car, your insurance covers it because it's water damage. So just so you know.
Wow.
Yeah. Make sure you take the old car, but whatever. just in case. But yeah, your body does know how to birth. So whether it's first or second, and one of the things that I really, when we're talking about supporting, you're going to have non-supportive providers. They're constantly talking about you. It's dangerous. You got to have your repeat C-section. You're going to have tolerant ones that, well, yeah, we can try for a BVAC. Okay. Try is my favorite word they're going to give you right from the beginning. And then they say, if you go into labor by 39 weeks or 40 weeks, we can try it. When has anyone ever put a time limit on nature? You know, if those roses will bloom by May 1st,
we'll keep them.
Otherwise, we're tearing that whole rose bush out because it's not going to work. Like, you can't put a time limit on nature. That is stupid, for one. It's not scientifically proven, for two. That's a made up patriarchal bull crap that means I don't believe in your body and I don't believe in physiological birth. I don't believe you can do it. That is not, I would even say that's not a tolerant provider. That's a, I still don't believe you can do it. Anyone that gives you that cutoff is, that's not true. It's made up. That's just not, there's no science to back that. Supportive provider, as in Dr. Kapp, as in Dr. Cobb locally too, fully supports VBAC. How are you preparing nutritionally? What's your education like? Do you have a doula? All right, let's see what happens. This baby's story hasn't even happened. We're going to still do our checks. Everything's going to be fine. Like, also, I noticed with Dr. Kapp and some midwives that it's so beautiful when you go into your appointment, how's this baby doing today? Not, let's make sure everything's okay.
Yeah, good.
The
good
language.
Tip. Yes.
So different, right? You can be censoring your OB right now. We want to make sure everything's okay. So we're going to make sure you're doing 2 non-stress tests a week, starting at 36 weeks. You know what that actually means? It means I get to bill for 2 non-stress tests for some new CPT codes going in your file so that my practice makes more money.
Yeah. And that's you're BS.
It's BS. You're a perfectly healthy 32-year-old. And I'm going to make sure that you do that. That's to convince you to be induced. There's no reason for that. And you wouldn't be doing that at a, you're low risk for one. At a midwife's clinic, you wouldn't be doing that. Maybe seeing your heartbeat, measuring your stomach and saying, how you, and peeing in a cup.
Yep.
And how are you doing?
To you and about your heart and your baby and your mind and how are you feeling and how exciting is this? And you're about to be parents and all of the other things. It's not just this, like, you know, the tenet that birth workers are constantly saying and trying to pound over the head of people is birth is not a medical event in most situations. I mean, I always have to give that disclaimer because I know there will be people who say, well, this happened to me and da da da. And it's like, okay, yes, I understand. And we have to just remember that like the overwhelming majority do not fit in a category where birth is a medical event. And we have to not forget that.
But we can put an overwhelming majority into that event.
We are right now. We're on the track for that. It's insane.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that we need to understand when we're going into the medical system. Doctors are not trained in normal physiological birth. They don't understand it. They don't believe in it. Midwives too, you guys, they were not all of midwives. This isn't a blanket statement, but if they were RNs, nurses beforehand, only raised in the hospital setting, and then they do their 3-year midwifery rotation in the hospital setting, how have they had that much experience with normal physiological, no intervention birth? They just haven't had that.
So you're talking about CNMs. So if people don't know, so it's certified nurse midwives, but there are also other midwifery forms like certified midwives and then
CPM. We've got midwife and lay midwives too, right? That's all they do are vaginal births that are at home, at your home, at their home, whatever. So yes, midwives are vaginal birth experts, of course, because they aren't surgeons. However, physiological birth is a totally different than an unmedicated birth. Like totally different.
Or so, than a medicated birth, you mean? Than a medicated.
No, unmedicated.
Wait, physiological birth is different from unmedicated?
So physiological, hands off.
Right.
Let's see what's happened. Unmedicated might mean you had interventions along the way, but you didn't have medication.
Oh, wow. There is a difference. In my mind, I think I always put those as being equals, but you're right. No, there could be a lot of interventions.
A lot of interventions, a lot of extra cervical checks, a lot of different, a lot of postponing things because we had to do a procedure because, right? Whereas leaving you to your own devices and, you know, the midwife's in the corner, like, you know, knitting.
Yeah.
You know, talking and chilling with her, you know, homies in the corner, everything's cool. There's no reason to do anything because she's in her process. Yep. I'm out. Right. Yep. Like that is a totally different than taking someone out of their environment, putting them under bright lights, no training, no education, no connection to that. Yeah, you can do it unmedicated. It might have been really, really a big experience you weren't expecting because you didn't have the physiological understanding, know-how, connection.
And tools. The tools are huge. Here's the thing too. I just really want to say before we wrap it up is that you may be planning a hospital birth. And you may be planning to get an epidural, but you all must know, everyone must know that you may not have time to get an epidural. Your epidural may not work. You must have tools in order to work with your body and ride the surges, ride the contractions. I mean, without putting like a lot of, you know, fear around it, it's a very intense experience. And if you've never thought about what you're going to do during a contraction or even wrapped your mind around what's happening or any of that information because you were just really banking on this possibility. What is that's all it
that
is.
That can be your birth trauma. Yes. You weren't banking on it.
Yes. And the intensity of those sensations could absolutely be traumatizing to someone who had no preparation and idea that that was what was going to happen, especially if it went on for a very long time. And then they had, you know, your mind just goes off. I had one moment, probably in total, it lasted 90 seconds. In my 4th baby's birth, at the very end, right before her head was born, where I lost it. Like I lost it. I went out of my groove. I was not in my space anymore. And I'd never experienced that to that level in all of my four births, even with my first birth. With my first birth, it was like a very classic because it was, you know, long and whatever, he was in the wrong position, et cetera, that I did have a very full, like labor land, you know, hormonal soup going on in my brain. I was not in the room. Like I don't know where I was, but I was not there either way. But even in that birth, I never had this type of a moment where I was just starting to fly off the rails of not coping. And in the moment, metacognitively, I thought to myself, if this is how some women's entire labor was, are you kidding? Like it was horrible for those 90 seconds. I was like grappling. I felt like I was climbing up a mountain where the rocks were sliding down and I was just like falling into a pit or something.
I had the exact same experience for one contraction. And I went, it like was real. Like, yeah. Oh my gosh, no wonder.
Yes. No like, wonder. That's what I thought.
No wonder. And then my lovely doula was like, how's that working for you? And I'm like, are you trying to Dr. Phil me right now? Are you kidding? But she brought me back. Yeah, I learned what not to be with that doula. But she brought me back into the moment of get back into it. And then I was like, oh my gosh. But that realization of how people can experience it, I was like, no wonder. And yeah. And I also, in hypnobirthing, yes, we're going for an unmedicated birth, right? Some of us, not all of us when they take that class. But I let them know if we're doing, some of them just do the hypnobirthing techniques until they want their epidural, but they want their epidural later because they know it will help prevent more interventions, right? They don't want to get it at 1 centimeter. They want to get it at 7, 8, 9. And when they decide to call in that anesthesiologist who may not be available, right? And we still have to get 2 bags of saline in your arm and all this stuff in prep for that epidural. You still have to use your techniques or you will lose your shit. And that will be the longest hour and a half of your life.
Yep.
We don't want it to be that way. So knowing even that when I'm asking for pain relief, I still have to keep myself centered. I still have to breathe. I still have to move. I still have to do it and block out the timeline because it's not instant. And if we immediately shift to where is it, that's going to be horrifically long. And
yeah,
everybody needs those coping skills. You need to understand how your body works so that you can deal with it because you are so freaking powerful. Your body knows how to do this. And if your mind is engaged in it, you can do it.
Yep. It's really just, it's almost like us against our mind, but we don't want it to be like that. We want it to be you with your mind and working on that. And then also it's a microcosm to the macrocosm of life, right? Like if you have these tools for how to deal with difficult moments, especially with parenting, like there, I think it's a very beautiful, obviously birth is really intense, but it's like a beautiful, you know, the Kool-Aid man breaking through the brick wall to be like, hey, welcome into parenthood.
Right. And,
you know, now it's like we have these, if we have some tools to deal with the adverse moments that we're probably going to experience in the next 18 years plus, it's just, it's shifted from one situation to the next, but like we need to have coping mechanisms and coping skills. And with birth, it's very movement and breath based. And that's what I love about your class is the actual practicing of contractions. Like set a timer for a minute and move around with your partner and breathe and feel what that time span is like, and then have a 3 or 4 minute gap in between and then do it again. And know that if you've practiced it, it's partially at least ingrained in your body so that when you are presented with the real deal and you're on doing it, you are at least a little bit more familiar and it's not all new and you can be like, hey, this is what I'm doing. I'm chugging through this. Like your class is just care. It's so good. I just really have to tell people it is so good. If you're looking for something, a hypnobirthing class specifically, and with a really amazing, engaged and hilarious educator who is going to keep the partners definitely, you know, on their toes, I think also it would be you. It's you.
We may tell some jokes. Yeah.
Yes.
Honestly, you have to honor the sensations of your body. And if you've never done anything hard, I had never done anything hard. The Presidential Fitness Award when I was 6th grade was like the hardest thing. And I was the chubby kid. I totally failed it. I couldn't even make the weight on that, whatever that was. Right. And birth was my first hard thing. I had never done anything physically taxing. And I know some people who are marathon runners. They're like, that kicked my ass. I'm like, a marathon didn't, but they also understand the mindset body connection. And the practice that you do prepares you for when you add the sensation on, because then you're just like, oh, it's just a sensation. I'm going to breathe through it because you have got that practice down. Yep. It's important. And it's important for anybody who's planning on going medicated, anybody who's even planning on a cesarean. I've got moms, you know, that come into class knowing they're going to have a cesarean. And we work through those same breathing patterns with what could be scary in surgery for them. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a mindset shift and it's a body integration that we've lost in our society needs to come back. And your confidence level for a VBAC needs to be at its peak. And if you can start with taking care of your body and your emotions and then move into the education and building that support and finding your right team, your confidence level is enormous. And then you can go, you're not my favorite provider. You are the only one I have, but I'm doing my thing and I hope you're here for the ride. Yeah. That is a different shift in energy. Yeah. Right. Because it's your body, it's your birth. And you can always change your mind if you decide, you know what, this is too intense. I would like to go into a cesarean. That's your choice. But aren't you glad that you have done the work that you did to be able to go, and I'm going to change my mind at any time? Because you can always change your mind at any time. But understanding that you have the power and the confidence to do what your body and your baby need you to do, even if it's another cesarean, because maybe your placenta is, you know, caught in your scar and now physiologically we have to do another cesarean, then how are we going to prep for that so that it's a beautiful experience, so that I feel empowered, so that I get skin to skin in the OR, so I can see my baby come out? There's a lot of ways to prepare for a gentle cesarean too. That can transition you into still having a beautiful birth with this next baby. It's still their birth. It's still their birth.
This is like more than I could have ever wished for. So thank you so much for coming on. And we should probably have more episodes in the future because I feel like we could just continue to talk about this. And even about that last topic you just mentioned, which is a gentle cesarean, a lot of people have never heard of that. So we can delve into that at a future date. But thank you so much, Care, and all of your information and for the contacts that you have, your classes, and even the free resources. Everything's going to be in the show notes. So be sure to check that out so that you can find Care and continue learning. Your Instagram account is also really, really insightful and hilarious and all the things you. So love it. Thank you for coming on today.
Thanks for letting me showcase your beautiful body in my birth classes.
Yeah, you're welcome. Are you pregnant or trying to conceive and looking for reliable, engaging education around how to have a healthy pregnancy and prepare for the future aspects of motherhood to come, like birth, breastfeeding, and postpartum? Look, I've got you. This is exactly the education you'll receive with my 6-week pregnancy call. You get access to my most comprehensive resource of everything that I wish women knew before heading into motherhood. It's a pregnancy health course, birth prep series, breastfeeding 101 course, and postpartum planning class, all in one. And for 6 straight weeks, we meet for an hour each week on Zoom with a small group of like-minded women going through it too, for you all to ask me questions and get clarity from a trusted expert. I can walk through it with you and hold your hand. The 6-week pregnancy call is only offered 4 times a year, so get on the wait list now. Head to milkmedicine.com for more information or click the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now and it starts with you.